Welcome, everybody, to this edition of Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. This is Cliff Dunne, your host, coming to you from Oakland today. It's March 15th, 2014. This is going to be a really interesting program. We're going to cover a great deal of material that goes as far back as the 12th century and basically starts in the 1920s with the discovery of long-distance echoes, or LDEs. We've covered the Epsilon Buddhis constellation and even touch on Stonehenge and other megaliths. So I'm really excited to be presenting our next guest to join us shortly. He's going to be calling in from Scotland. And I want to just double-check something real quickly here and make sure that he is able to join us. So as a reminder, this is a recording that will be available on Facebook and will be probably available in the next couple of hours following the broadcast. Any questions or concerns, you can email me on Facebook. I don't always get to that quickly, but I should be able to respond within a short period of time. In the 1950s, the United States developed long-range ballistic missiles working to cover a larger section of a specific area for deployment of weapons. But along with that, they also were extending their radar to the upper atmosphere and into space. These improvements allowed them to scan the and space around our planet. Around the same time these advancements were underway, the Russians launched Sputnik, a crude yet functional satellite, into orbit. The Americans would later produce their own satellite and launch it into production a few months later, and that satellite was called Explorer 1. Both countries were tracking the flight of their satellites, and they made a startling discovery. Among the flight paths of the satellite, they also discovered a number of foreign objects. One of these objects was later identified as the Black Knight satellite by the press. The military didn't know what they had there. They were capturing on radar a object on polar orbit. And the reason that made everyone curious is because neither the Russians or the Americans were able to launch a vehicle into a polar orbit. And they discovered this satellite revolving around the Earth. So we're going to hear a short clip of an interview with reporter Mike Wallace and retired Major Donald Keyhold, which aired on ABC television in 1958. We're going to hear Wallace asking Keyhold, who at the time was the co-founder of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomenon, why he was reporting these UFOs and what he thought they were. So here's a listen.
What they do down here.
What is your theory? In other words, you suggest that they come from Mars or from other planets, from other solar systems possibly throughout the universe. Is that correct?
Yes, and there are a lot of scientists who said the same thing.
What is your theory as to the kind of people who fly these, or the kind of beings who fly these saucers?
Well, that's speculation. Willie Lay said recently they'd be just like the man next door, the invaders from space, and his reasons may be good. But most of the top scientists have said that the odds are that beings from other worlds would not be like us. Some of them would be. Dr. Harlow Shapley, for instance, said that there probably were at least 100 million inhabited planets in the universe. And Menzel, who doesn't believe in saucers at all, says that he goes that high or even higher. And among those, by the law of averages, a certain number of planets that would be like the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if evolution started at the same time, why, you might have the same type of being.
What do you think of the intentions?
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I think what we'll go do here is I'm just going to introduce you. I just played a clip from Mike Wallace and Major Donald Keyhold,
uh-huh,
who basically were discussing the UFO issues. And now, you're an author with an emphasis on astronomy, space flight, and science fiction. You're also a researcher, tutor, critic, editor, lecturer, and broadcaster. And you're known for your science writings and for your work on the Site Hill Stone Circle. So, and your current book is Children of the Sky, which we'll discuss in a little bit later. But I would like to start with Bracewell theory that you basically worked with on your deciphering of the LDEs. Can you tell us a little bit about your discovering LDEs? Were you just searching through books, or how did that come up?
I had set up a project within the Scottish National Spaceflight Society called ASTRA to write a book on interstellar travel and communication. And the late John McVeigh mentioned Bracewell's theory. He was himself an amateur astronomer and an author in this field. And he drew the attention of the group to these two papers by Bracewell, which had appeared in Nature and then been reprinted in a book called Interstellar Communication. And this, he was talking about how one civilization would attract the attention of another, and he suggested the best way was to send actual spacecraft to potential life-bearing planetary systems. And they should try to attract attention, he suggested, by recording any radio signals that they heard and playing them back to the planet of origin. And this, he then went on to say, this would produce an effect like the mysterious long-delayed radio echoes of the 1920s, which were never explained. So I discovered that these had been published at the time in Nature back in the late 1920s, and I got hold of the actual results that appeared. And at first glance, it looked like some kind of random phenomenon, and I actually wrote it up as probably a natural phenomenon. Now, something made me go back to Bracewell's papers, and at the end of one of them he had said, should we be surprised if the first message from an interstellar probe was a television image of a constellation to tell us where it had come from? And the thought that occurred to me was, the stars are spaced at random in the sky, so a set of star map coordinates would be a random series of numbers. So I tried taking the delay times of these so-called echoes, which actually weren't true echoes because they were coming back with constant intensity, however long they were delayed. And this was on experimental signals being broadcast from Philips at Eindhoven in the Netherlands. And people around the world were listening out for these. And the first long delayed echoes were actually heard in Oslo. And well, when I tried drawing a graph of the delay time against the order in which the so-called echoes had happened, at first I didn't see anything significant, but I tried reversing the axes, putting the significant variable on the x-axis instead of the y-axis, as we would normally do, and suddenly found myself looking, to my complete amazement, at what appeared to be a map of the constellation Bootes, the herdsman, with one star picked out. And that star proved to be Epsilon Bootes, an orange giant star, apparently a dying star, one that if there was a civilization there, they might very well want to get away from. It provided a motivation for their program, which was something Frank Drake had asked about in the same issue of the same volume interstellar communication.
Let me ask you a quick question. So how I'm ignorant to how you would take these echoes. How did you have some kind of a graph that you fill in, or how would you know to create a map from delayed echoes? I explain that part of it, because I don't understand how that works.
Well, you had the sequence that was published in Nature of this apparently random series of numbers, which were the actual delay times, like 5 seconds, 8 seconds, 12 seconds, and so on. So I simply graphed sequence on one axis and delay time on the other, on as you say, on graph paper. In fact, initially, I did it on the corner of a page. I did it freehand. And as I say, found myself, to my astonishment, looking at something recognizable.
Okay, interesting. So tell me, you ended up developing a number of maps. How many maps in total did you develop from the LDEs?
Well, now let me do a quick count in my head. There were, I think, three or four from the first day, and then another one in the evening. Then there were very extensive series of echoes that were heard the following year in 1929 in a French experiment, and there were 12 sets there. So you're talking about between 15 and 20 altogether.
Mm-hmm. And then those were all disproven except for a handful, or how did you distill it down to one map that really felt like it could be the real McCoy, the real thing?
Well, at the time, I didn't even think that one was. What happened was the star Epsilon Boötis, according to the catalogs, was 103 light years away. And I worked out from the translation that I thought I was getting of the signals, I worked out the dimensions of their planetary system, and it looked as if life had evolved on the second planet and later emigrated to the sixth planet when the sun became too hot for them. And I translated the other signal patterns as I thought consistently with that to give us a picture of what their program was. And at first it all looked very good, except that there was a problem about the colour of the minor sun. Epsilon Boötis is a double star. The main one is an orange giant. The lesser star is blue and appeared to be too bright for what we were getting from the figures from the catalogues and how the translation I was coming up with seemed to tie in with them. And a chap called Tony Lawton in the British Interplanetary Society had become involved in the investigation. He contacted Yale, and he got the very latest figures from then on the distance of Epsilon Boötis, and it turned out to be 203 light years. This was apparently an error that had been perpetrated through multiple catalogues. It should have been 203 and not 103. And when you redo the calculations on that basis, the planetary system comes out uninhabitable, and in fact it would never have been habitable. The whole idea that life had evolved there and gone through this sequence that I thought I had deduced just fell apart. And then by 1976 I was trying to withdraw the whole thing, because I had come to the conclusion I was wrong. And it wasn't until a long time afterwards, on an entirely different field of research, you mentioned Stonehenge and the pyramids, and that was where Epsilon Boötis suddenly came back. And suddenly it began to look as if that one apparent map of Boötis might, after all, be a message of some kind.
I see. Now, let me just quickly read this message as you decoded it. It says, "Start here. Our home is Epsilon Boötis, which is a double star. We live on the sixth planet of the seven, coming from the sun, which is the larger of the two. Our sixth planet has one moon. Our fourth planet has three. Our first and third planets each have one. Our probe is in the position of Arcturus, known in our maps."
That last bit's garbled. It was correct up to there.
Okay. So was this a map that you came back to after the recalculation of light years?
That was part of the 1929 sequence. It's slightly, the translation you've got there is slightly garbled at the end. There's a bit missing. What it said was, the probe is in the L5 position in the orbit of the moon, and the position shown for the star Arcturus tells you what date it arrived here, which was about 13,000 years ago. However, as I said, when we got the actual astrophysical information accurately on the star system, the translation just didn't work anymore. It had to go. So that whole translation you've read out now appears to be invalid.
Okay. All right. Well, then let's discuss Epsilon Bootis now. Is there a connection with that planetary system and Earth that you've discovered?
Yes. Now, this was a jaw-dropper because at that point when this happened, I thought I had... the whole thing was in the past and discarded as far as I was concerned. But when my book, Man and the Stars, came out, I was contacted by a chap called Alan Evans, who was in British military intelligence at the time, and was very insistent that his contact with me had to be kept secret, not because of any cover-up reasons, but because it would finish his army career if it got out. Yeah, this was purely a private interest on his part. And he said, I like the approach that you're taking to the whole question of past contact. Let's see if we can put our respective skills together and make something out of it. Alan is long since out of the army, so we can talk about this now. But he has the most extraordinary grasp of spatial relationships. He can just look at points on a map or points in the sky on a star map or a globe and tell at a glance how they are related. And what particularly he wanted me to look at was some markings at Stonehenge, which he had found on high-resolution military photographs of Salisbury Plain. And these were markings that weren't on the official plans. And he thought that they might represent galactic coordinates, which would be extraordinary if true, because you can't determine a galactic coordinate system without a radio telescope. And so he thought this might be an indication that somebody had come to visit Stonehenge. And cutting a long story short, he turned out to be right. You can go to a planetarium, you can set the date for roughly 2800 BC at the time of Stonehenge 1, and you can see for yourself that once a day, as the sky turns, the Milky Way lines up with the horizon, and the galactic center is then on the horizon, the galactic pole is overhead, and the whole of Stonehenge becomes galactically aligned. It is quite extraordinary, but you can check that part of it optically. Mm-hmm. But what I then set out to do was to see if it might be coincidence, and there might be some star that was passing overhead at Stonehenge, which was what made the builder locate it where they did. And to my utter astonishment, the star it turned out to be was Epsilon Bootis. And
oh my God!
Suddenly it was back after I had thrown the whole thing.
So was it Stonehenge 1 that was the correlation, or was it the other two?
No, Stonehenge 1. Very definitely. Now,
okay.
Alan went on from there, looking at the Stonehenge alignments. And he discovered that in ecliptic coordinates, there was a geometric relationship between the position of Stonehenge on the Earth and the position of the pyramids. And when we looked at the alignments of the pyramids, but the first pyramid, the step, which was the Step Pyramid of Djoser, and the last one, the Great Pyramid at Giza, to our astonishment, we found the same two galactic alignments built into those two structures. Mm. And we were doing lots of cross-checking on other pyramids and other stone circles and all kinds of things. We weren't finding any galactic stuff anywhere else. But now we had Stonehenge and the pyramids with the same galactic relationships at roughly the same time, and it looked as if there was something going on. So we showed this to Robert Bevall when he came to Glasgow on a lecture tour, and he came up with something quite astonishing. He said, it's the same Giza in what I call the first time. You get the Stonehenge orientation there 10,500 years ago. So we were showing him this in the planetarium at the Nautical College. So we took it back to that date, and lo and behold, it was right. Which takes us back to the apparent date of the long delayed echo map. And then from there, we thought, well, we'd better look and see what's happening at Stonehenge at that date. We're talking now roughly 12,500, 13,000 years ago. So we reset the planetarium to Stonehenge, leaving the date there. And when we let the sky spin round, Epsilon Botus went through the zenith again.
Oh, in fact,
it had been at the zenith at Stonehenge all the way back at that date in the Ice Age, where it was almost under the glaciers at the time, when Giza had the galactic alignments. And it all happened again at the time of Stonehenge 1 and the actual building of the pyramids. So,
did Bevall have anything to say about this this conclusion? Because he must have had his eyes opened up pretty good when he saw your material.
Oh, he was fascinated, but he had Graham Hancock with him, who is absolutely against all forms of fast contact with extraterrestrials, and he got very angry, and he said, "No, it's all." He of all people said, "There's nothing to it. Must be a coincidence."
He left the room quickly, is what you're saying.
Oh, he kept his temper, but he was very put out.
This is fascinating. Well, okay, so take us to you both were able to determine that it was the Great Pyramid and Stonehenge, but you didn't find any other monoliths or any other Stonehenge types of structures that correlated to Epsilon Botus.
Only the Step Pyramid, which is on the same longitude as the Great Pyramid, and seemed to be part of what Alan was calling by this time the four-dimensional grid. We didn't find it anywhere else, and we did look long and hard trying to find other similar correlations.
So let's deduce what does this mean? What do these connections mean? When an ancient people sets up a Stonehenge and the Giza pyramid that aligned directly with a constellation, what do we take away from that?
Well, if we speculate about it for a minute, the thing about the galactic alignments at Stonehenge is that they don't go through the center. It's as if there's something sitting in the center. Maybe Stonehenge has been built round it. And then it gets up and goes away, because they abandoned Stonehenge round about the time that the pyramids were started, and they didn't come back to Stonehenge till several hundred years later. My supposition is there was a ship and it landed first at Stonehenge and then in Egypt. And maybe it's still here somewhere. That's my guess.
So, by your accounting, Stonehenge is older than the pyramids, or the Giza Grand Pyramid.
Okay. Yes.
So,
I'm going with the generally recognized archaeological dates.
Yeah. Okay. So the hypothesis that you formed was that a ship came at the time of Stonehenge 1. And maybe disseminated information or whatever to that group, and then it left, and then came back to the Giza Plateau.
Yeah, when moved. Yeah. It probably didn't leave the Earth. It probably just moved. That's a guess, but that's my suggestion as the simplest possible explanation for what we're looking at. The evidence is all circumstantial, but it's the best circumstantial evidence I know of that somebody's been here.
Has anyone else looked at this research and come to a corresponding hypothesis or similar views?
Well, we've checked it in a lot of different ways. As far as the optical alignments are concerned, like I say, you can check them with any good astronomical computer program, or with your own eyes in a planetarium. You can actually take the machine to the date and the place, and you will actually see these things happen. Anyone who likes to go to my website and look at the article can check it out for themselves.
Okay. I guess the other question I would have while we're on the Epsilon Buddhist subject is, has Drake or anyone picked up any other LDEs since your research, or anything new that would give us any signals from anyone in that constellation?
Well, there's a very curious thing there. The long-delayed echo phenomenon seems to have stopped at the time when I published this stuff. There have been virtually no reliably reported instances since. And when Robert Freitas did optical searches of the Lagrange points in the orbit of the Moon looking for the Bracewell probe, he didn't find anything. But there is that curious object, 1991 VG, that reflects, which is now in orbit around the Sun, and seemingly passed either left here in 1975 or passed very, very close to the Earth-Moon system in 1975. Maybe that's the probe. It'll be back in, about another 8 years or so. We'll get another look at it. Maybe we're in for a surprise. But there hasn't. Nothing else has been happening.
Okay.
Except for my other area of research that I think you're going to go on to, which joined up unexpectedly with all this.
Yeah, we want to talk about Children from the Sky shortly here, but I want to just ask you a few more questions about this these Stonehenge and the Great Pyramid, the connection, because I find that fascinating. And I have not seen it. I definitely have to go out and get your book to read a little more about this. But so if these beings erected, are you saying that they erected the Stonehenge, or did they leave? What would be your hypothesis behind the creation of Stonehenge? Was that it was a mechanism to connect, and was there any other technology, subtle technology involved in Stonehenge other than an observatory?
Well, what we have to remember here is that Stonehenge was the last of the great circles. The other really big stone circles in the British Isles, except for Avebury. The other really big ones like Stinnes and the Ring of Brodgar were all centuries old by this time. It is as if Stonehenge, which is unique in so many ways, it's got features in common with the others, but it has so many differences, it's as if it was built round something. And my hunch is that just by landing there and sitting there, the ship itself could have had the necessary effect of getting people to build a circle round it that had the galactic alignment built in. If you've got a spaceship whose attitude control platform is lined up with galactic coordinates, which would make sense if it's a starship, if it lands on that latitude where the galactic pole passes overhead, its alignment platform will be in the correct orientation to the stars once a day. So it's as if they've done it whoever they are, done it deliberately to let us know they were here.
Hmm.
Now, I think we can take this a couple of steps further. Once we're capable of asking the question, have we been visited, I don't see any point in denying us the answer. So my guess is that if we follow this trail far enough, it will lead us to proof that they were here. That proof will be on Earth somewhere to find. And the most likely thing to find is the ship, because the Earth's a big planet. It is difficult to get off. I think it's probably still here somewhere.
You don't think after 13,000 years that it would kind of, disintegrate?
If it was a wreck, yes, it would. When Alan Evans first contacted me, he actually suggested that we look for wrecks. He said, if there's anybody been here with a major expedition, maybe they had a couple of accidents. Let's look for wrecked ships. But we talked to some air accident investigators and similar people, and they all said, if you wreck a sophisticated vehicle and leave it just lying around on the Earth's surface for thousands of years, it won't be recognizable. Yeah, it will disintegrate. You'd have to take steps to preserve it. So it would have to be, to quote 2001, A Space Odyssey, deliberately buried, huh? Yes. That would need to be.
Interesting. And Egypt, the Giza Plateau and the Grand Pyramid, are you saying that there was a group that built it after the contact, or perhaps the people, because that is a very sophisticated monument, extremely sophisticated, massive, multi-ton stones moved into position. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a monstrous structure. People like engineer Chris Dunn and John Anthony West and many others find that dynastic Egyptians could not have put it together. So that leaves it open. So,
well, my friend Chris O'Kane, who invented a remarkable system of panoramic photography called Vistamorph, I introduced him to Robert Bavall, and he went out to Giza with Bavall, and he brought out some spectacular pictures, some of which are in my book about ancient astronomy called The Stones and the Stars. I think there certainly are some major puzzles about how it was built, but I'm still inclined to think that the Egyptians built it. But it does look as if they were given a couple of hints as to putting these galactic alignments into the structure, so that it would show the link to Stonehenge and reinforce it, the galactic connection. It's astonishing stuff, because it's not a coincidence. It's coincidence multiplied by coincidence multiplied by many more coincidences, until you have to start saying there's something really going on here.
But I find it interesting if a civilization was sophisticated enough to travel multiple light years to get to Earth, that would be, in today's view, if we saw that craft, that would be a UFO. And yet you tell me you don't believe in the current UFO phenomenon, and I just find that interesting. Can you explain why you don't believe any of the sightings that are all over the place are legitimate? I'm just curious.
Well, it's what it all adds up to. If the successive, just to take the British and American governments as an example, if they know that they're being overlooked by a higher civilization whose achievements they need in some way to emulate, why do they keep cancelling space programs? why did Nixon cancel the Apollo program when the whole solar system was there for the taking? Why does this kind of thing keep happening? Britain nearly had parity with the USA and Russia back in 1960. It was an amazing achievement done on virtually a shoestring budget. But the British government response to it was, well, we'll just shut the whole thing down. It's not of any importance. It doesn't matter. Margaret Thatcher did it all over again in 1987. And if you contrast her reaction to the Argentine invasion of the Falkland Islands, she immediately said, oh, at last, something interesting for me to get my teeth into. She said that in public. And she sent a military task force at enormous cost and risk, which took back the islands with great loss of life. But supposedly when she's told that British airspace is being invaded repeatedly by extraterrestrial spacecraft who are doing all kinds of strange things to British citizens, she says, oh, that's dreadful. I must cancel the British space program and go and hide under the bed. Completely out of character for the woman. I don't believe it. And one of the things that I think now particularly illustrates the point is that, as far as I can gather, there is absolutely nothing about UFOs in WikiLeaks. This is a big international conspiracy. It ought to be full of references to UFOs in WikiLeaks. It's just not there. So I don't believe we're currently in a contact situation. I think the idea that we have been visited in the past, I find much more interesting, partly because it does open up really fascinating channels of investigation. You can get your teeth into it, and I hope you're going to come on to the other case sooner or later.
Yes, yes. Well, that's what we're moving to now. So I have read some excerpts of your latest book, Children from the Sky, and I find it fascinating. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your discovery of Woolpit and the earthworks out there and this connection to these two kids, go ahead, and the two children that were discovered.
Yes, okay. You could not have a more different type of investigation to the two that we've been talking about so far, the radio echoes and the ancient astronomy. But just to keep your listeners on the edge of their chairs, we are going to join them up, to my amazement, it turned out. But, okay, going back to where I first picked up on this, when I was a student, one of the set texts I had to read was The Anatomy of Melancholy, written by Robert Burton in the early 17th century, which is primarily a medical textbook, but its literary interest is that he was a Renaissance man and he put down everything he knew about everything. And right in the middle of this enormous work comes his, what he calls, a digression of the air, in which he sets down everything that he knows about astronomy and meteorology. And one of the things he's very excited by is that Galileo and others have now proven that, in particular, Mars and Venus are planets resembling the Earth. And with the beliefs of his time, he jumped to the conclusion that therefore they must be inhabited, because there would have been no point in creating them otherwise. And then you get this great throwaway line. It may be that those two green children that fell from the sky, that Nubrigensis writes of in his time, came from thence. And when I looked at that, I thought, little green men? Back in... Well, I checked back. I discovered that Nubrigensis was William of Newborough, who was a 12th century historian. And I discovered that the same story was told by another historian of the time called Ralph of Coggeshall. When eventually, years later, I started to research this in detail, I discovered that the two of them had written their accounts of the matter, having investigated it, in William's case, and actually being involved in it, in the case of Ralph of Coggeshall. And they had written their accounts from completely different viewpoints and using different vocabulary and at different times. And unlike most cases where you get a wonderful event in the medieval chronicles, they all describe it in exactly the same words because they're copying from one another. But these two accounts had been written separately, which seemed to help enormously. Now, what you have got is that at the village of Woolpit, near Bury St. Edmunds in East Anglia, on a day that I have pinned down to late July of 1173, two very strange children came out of an ancient earthwork from which the village took its name, nominally. And they were wearing clothing of a colour and material never seen before, speaking a language that nobody recognised. And both of these things are odd because Woolpit was an aspiring market town on the major pilgrim route in England. But the third thing, which was to the people of the time, the jaw dropper, was that they were coloured green all over. Now, it seems that initially they were treated quite roughly. It was discovered that they were green all over. And they were put on public show. And nobody even thought to feed them to begin with. But they were getting, obviously, into a distressed condition, and common sense took over. The children were taken to the home of a knight called Richard de Calne, where they still wouldn't eat anything they were offered. But when the bean harvest started, they recognised the colour of the bean plants, and for a long time afterwards they would eat nothing but green beans. Now, when After a year, the boy was dying of melancholia, interestingly enough, which is a condition accentuated by a compound called tyramine found in green beans. But meanwhile, they had lost the green colour. By this time, they were eating normal food, and they had learned our manner of speaking, unquote. And it seemed to the wise that they might be christened, and even that was done.
Wow.
And now, just to get a little bit ahead of myself here, at this point, I realized by this time I had to do my own Latin translation because modern versions of this story aren't accurate. Both Latin accounts at this point go into formal language. And when I checked up on this, even today, a christening in the Roman Catholic Church in controversial circumstances must be preceded by a formal inquiry called an inquisitio, conducted by a bishop. And anyone reading either chronicle back then would have known that. So they wouldn't have been surprised that the next bit goes, they gave evidence that, and they swore on oath that. Now, so asked, this is very clever wording, asked who and from whence they were, they are said to have replied, we are people of the land of St. Martin. And everybody has taken that to mean, this is where they came from. But in fact, the land of St. Martin was the Essex property of the principal sanctuary in England, controlled by the Bishop of London. And what they were saying in reply to his question was, who are you? We are people who are already under your protection. So he pretends not to understand that. And he says, oh, that sounds all right. Do they believe in our Saviour there? Which would be a very strange question if it was named after a Christian saint. And the kids, who have obviously been briefed on what to say, say, oh yes, it's full of churches. So they're nearly home here. The only question that the bishop still has to ask is, does the sun rise or set there? Because in medieval England, it was believed that there was no sun in fairyland. And all they've got to say is yes. But the girl couldn't bring herself to lie at that point, and she launched into a description of a land where the sun never rose or set, but was separated by a very broad river from a country of permanent twilight. Which is,
and this,
like,
this is actually documented. They actually documented her. Okay. Continue.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And she's saying, this is not Earth. In fact, it's not any planet in the solar system. It's a planet keeping the same face always towards its sun. What she's describing is literally the twilight zone. And Burton, of course, realized that this couldn't be Earth. That was why, in The Anatomy of Melancholy, he suggested they'd come from Mars or Venus. He talks about them falling from the sky, although they actually came out of this hole in the ground. So I had always meant to do something about this. And eventually, I was covering a conference in London for the Glasgow Herald on the Rosetta mission, which is on its way to a comet right now. And I decided to go up to East Anglia and get some local colour to write an article about the Green Children. And I got together with a historian friend and said, well, what questions should I be asking? And he worked out with me a list of questions. So I'm wandering around the village of Wooltit, if you can imagine, in September of 2003. And getting a great reception, they opened up the local history museum for me and the whole bit. But in reply to my questions, people kept saying, you'll have to go to the county records office for that sort of thing. So I went into Bury St Edmunds and joined the county archive research network. And literally they said to me, there's the card index, tell us what you want to see. And 5 hours later, I knew I was onto something really big, to the extent that I spent the next 10 years more or less full time on it.
Oh my God.
And this, whatever it is, this thing really happened. And the people involved in it were the big names of the time. Richard de Calnat turns out to be extremely important. He's very hard to trace. But the reason he's hard to trace is that he was effectively the head of the Secret Service at the time. He was excused all taxes by the king because of his outstanding service to the crown. And at that point, he simply disappears from the records for the rest of his life, except when he witnesses an occasional grant to the church, because he's invisible. He's the king's spymaster. And this is the man that the Green Children are taken to. But it turns out they were expecting something to happen in Woolpit. The king had already annexed the village from Bury St Edmunds Abbey, who owned it, and put the richest man in the country in charge of it, with the excuse that he was just a poor clerk and needed a few pounds a year from the village. But this was a very wealthy man that he put in charge. And the Pope got involved. And you'll find it in any history books that go into this much detail that the Pope ordered the king to return the village to Bury St Edmunds Abbey. But the Pope's letter survives, and what it actually says is, concerning St Mary Woolpit, I have ordered that the king is to return it to you when he has finished with it. Which is an entirely different matter. Whatever it is, we're onto something big. As my late friend John Braithwaite said, if it's not extraterrestrial contact, you've got the political thriller of old time.
So are you saying that they were preparing for contact, and that's when the two children showed up, or are you saying that after the children showed up, then things got funny?
No, things were already funny. The children, it looks as if the appearance of the children was an accident. When they were asked how they got to Woolpit, having described life on another world, when they were asked how they got to Woolpit, the reply was that they had been out, it had happened to them because they were out with their father's livestock on a certain day. And the way this is constructed in Latin, It's a very strong causative sentence that if they had not gone out with the livestock that day, this would not have happened. They shouldn't have been out. They suddenly heard a great sound of bells, which they compared to the sound of the bells at Bury St Edmunds, but they were quite clear that it wasn't that, it was like it. And then, fascinatingly, the girl says, suddenly, as if placed in some absence of mind, we found ourselves in the field where you were reaping. One fascinating thing about it is that she not only knows what amnesia is, but she knows she hasn't got it. She says, as if, some absence of mind. And this is not a runaway from a primitive tribe in the woods, which other people have been trying to make out. This kid is educated. She's sophisticated, and she's on trial for her life, and she's still playing word games.
What I find interesting, though, is that you connect the earthworks at Woolpit to, is that where they came, where they were reported to have come from? The ancient stone circle I'm not sure it's a circle, but the earthworks there at Woolpit, is that the connection?
It's heart-shaped. The feature that fits the description is a heart-shaped, very large moated feature with a holy well at the point of the heart. And it definitely dates back to at least the 12th century as a place of pilgrimage. And this heart-shaped moat is huge. It is quite big enough for children to have hidden in when they first arrived, which is what they said they did. Mm-hmm. And that's what the feature at Woolpit that fits the bill. They said that never having seen the sun before, they were utterly astonished by the brightness and heat of the sun. But eventually they made a run across the fields, and the harvesters caught them. And that was how it went from there. But this is obviously a much bigger story than we can cover in the time we've got on this program. But I have, as you say, got a full length book out of it. It took me 18 years to find a publisher, because the historical publishers didn't want it because it had extraterrestrials in it. And the speculative publisher didn't want all this detailed history.
So, you were stuck in the middle, I guess.
Eventually, I met John Martin of Mutus Liber in Edinburgh, and he took the plunge, and he's done the book, which is very gratifying that it's in print. So now that I've got all the history on record, I can do a more popular version, which I do intend to write. But for the moment, it's the book's out there. It's available from Amazon and all large booksellers, and it does go into the whole thing in tremendous detail. So we'd better get to the Epsilon Botus connection, hadn't we?
That's my next question. But before we go there, can you tell me? Did you detect a connection with the earthworks as possible an energy source for the trans, the travel, the whatever beam of light or whatever they traveled on from their planet to ours? Would you say that the earthworks had some connection with that?
Yes, I would, because one of the fascinating things that I found was, to begin with, people were saying to me, oh, medieval chronicles are full of events like this, you mustn't set any store by it. So I went and looked. I did a big survey on medieval chronicles looking for people appearing or disappearing. And I found there were actually very few cases. And some of them were just straightforward stories of witchcraft, which you could discount. But the ones that had interesting detail, when I checked up on them, turned out to be arranged in straight lines, north and south, through the British Isles, as if the habitable valley in the twilight zone of the planet the children described, as if it was mapped onto the Earth's surface. And even more extraordinarily, when you look at the history of these different places, of which there are about six, I think, altogether, it looks as if they're changing hands with the general sort of Brownian movement of medieval property. It's how you moved up and down in the days before, you know, the financial society as we had it today. You swapped for property. But if you do a spreadsheet of it, it turns out that these sites are actually being, the ownership of these sites is being swapped between just three families. And there's always somebody from one of these three families in charge at each site. And they have
got. Can you give me an example of one of the better known sites that you're talking about?
I don't know if you'd find them to be better known, but any Stanglia, for instance, Woolpit itself is due south of a place up on the coast of the Wash, where the Calna family had a lot of property. And it's due north of Coggeshall Abbey. And if you extend that line across the English Channel, you come to more places of interest. And there are two other lines parallel to that, one of which goes through Stonehenge.
There we go.
Yeah. So, there we go. When I published the material about Stonehenge and the pyramids that we've talked about, I had an article in Analogue in 1998, and I had said in it, is there any connection with the Green Children in it? Because the Analogue had already done my article about that. And I said, well, the only one that I can see is that the sun was very disturbed at both times. I went to talk to a physicist friend, and I said, if you've got a planet with a trapped rotation, it presumably won't have a magnetic field because it rotates so slowly. And he said, yes. So I said, okay, if the Earth's magnetic field is disturbed because the sun is disturbed, could you visualize a matter transmitter that would go wrong and have accidents? And he said, oh, yes, tell me what makes it go wrong. I can much easily figure out how it works. And he gave me a description, which I put in the book, which, again, is speculation, but interesting. However, it did then occur to me that if there was any connection between the Green Children's story and the other research, one of the sites should have the same galactic alignments that we'd already found at Stonehenge and the pyramids. So I called up Alan Evans and said, can you check this out for me? And he called me back 24 hours later and said, I've got it. It's medieval 12th century Jerusalem. Had exactly the same galactic orientation from 1146 to 1187. Had exactly the same galactic orientation that we find at Stonehenge 1 and at Giza. And I've got circumstantial evidence that puts the Kalna in Jerusalem at the beginning and the end of those of the period. So what it means, you've got these three quite different inquiries. One into 1920s radio echoes, one into Neolithic astronomy, and the third into these very human lost children that everybody is making such a fuss about for some reason in the 12th century. And all three of them are aspects of the same inquiry. They're all joined up. So I think we're onto something. We're onto something big. And
So let's go. Let's talk about: is there an Epsilon Buddhist connection here around the whole thing, or how does that fit?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't fit in with the Green Children, but it we've got it. Not so far. I haven't found a connection, but we've got it. Okay. We've got the galactic connection between the Green Children and the other inquiries, and Epsilon Buddhist is very significant there. Apparently, I would think now as a time marker rather than as an indicator of where it all actually comes from.
Mm-hmm. And so, where do these three points converge? What is the hypothesis for the three convergence that you are finding?
Okay, we are now into total speculation. I am now wearing my fiction right now.
Okay. I think our listeners would be happy to hear anything you have to say, Duncan.
Okay. The matter transmitter system that my friend came up with would be located on a space station. And the way it would work is that it would be tied in with a wormhole, which they would create suitably shielded within the space station. And they would put an electrostatic charge on it, roughly equivalent to what you would get, say, in a lightning storm or an auroral display on an Earth-like planet. and they set the spin to whatever rate they chose and wait until those conditions were matched on an Earth-like world somewhere else in the galaxy, at which point the portal would open. And a bit like Stargate SG-1, you then put a machine through so that you could, from then on, you could open the portal from the other side. Then, once you've got that link established, you alter the charge and or the gravity and open a portal to another Earth-like world, and so on, till you've got multiple gateways to lots of different worlds. And maybe what they then decided to do was to take a planet with a trapped rotation, with a habitable valley along the twilight zone, where they would have contained and controlled conditions, and they would experiment by putting life forms from the different worlds into that setting to see how they would interact. And this, interestingly, goes back to the question of why the children were green. Because the girl actually said, when she was asked, that all the people in the land that she came from were dyed with the same green colour, which was the colour of the plants. So it's camouflage. There's something hunting them. Maybe something crossing the river from the sunlight side that doesn't see so well in twilight. So if you're camouflaged and stand still, you can pass for a plant.
That's fascinating. I thought it was just a protection from the atmosphere, but now you have concluded that the green tint was camouflage, huh? Wow.
It's a guess. It's a guess, but there are elements in the story. There are hints in what the children said. They've got this very strong taboo about not eating anything they don't recognize, which is really strongly instilled into them. So there's non-terrestrial life as well as terrestrial life in this experimental setting, whatever it is. And maybe there's something that preys on them. It's maybe not such a friendly experiment, but it would fit. It would fit the facts. Why would all the people be dyed green and not the animals? Unless if it comes, you want it to take an animal and not a person. Because there's nothing about the animals being dyed green. Nothing at all. It starts to get a little bit more scary when you go into this kind of depth. But it must be emphasized, as I said, that we are speculating here. We're trying to build up a story from what few clues we have. The most frustrating thing is that William of Newborough says that the girl gave many other details of where the place that she came from to those who were inclined to be curious about it, but it would be tedious to set them down here.
Oh, my God. And that was my next question. I wanted to ask you if she described her planet. She didn't.
She described
her planet.
She gave many other details, and William didn't write them down. not at least in his published verse.
Well, this is the 12th century. I guess he couldn't be bothered.
Well, you have to look at it from his point of view. Before he goes into the story, he puts it in his section on miraculous events. And he saw himself as a Ghostbuster. This was an age when if you had the church attest to a miraculous event on your property, it was like having the U.S. Air Force build you a runway that could take jumbo jets. Suddenly you were on the tourist trail. And the pilgrims would come. And William saw it as his job to knock a lot of this stuff down. He thought there was far too much of it going on. And he narrowed it down to just four events that he couldn't disprove, three of which are more or less fairy stories, and he reckoned they could be accounted for by the actions of good and bad angels. But with the green children, he says, I hesitated to write this down because his argument is miracles are supposed to illustrate some point of scripture. and he couldn't see the point of it. And eventually he said, well, it's not. I've established that it really happened. I have interviewed so many witnesses and witnesses of such quality that I'm convinced that it really happened. And it's not for me to question God's actions. So I'm going to tell this. And at the four chapters later, at the end of the section, he goes back to it and he says, I really cannot figure this out, what it's all about, but it does not grieve me to have set down this most strange and wonderful event. But it bothers him because it's not a proper miracle. You know, it doesn't fit his religious purposes. But the details that the girl gave about the place that she gave from didn't either. Yeah, this hasn't got any religious significance. So he thinks it's boring.
That's fascinating. So it sounds like you're going to be doing a different edition of the Children from the Sky, or a re-edited version, or Cliff Notes. What are you discussing in your next book?
Well, I've discussed it with Sean Martin, and he feels that if I did a popular account of it without going into all the evidence, but just telling the story as a story with enough backup to show that I haven't made it up out of whole cloth, but without going into the detailed evidence that I've produced in the book, yeah, he says that's a book he feels he could make a success.
Wow.
So I'm not doing it right now. I've had two other books published since, one on ancient astronomy and the stone circle that I built, and the most recent one on protecting the Earth from asteroids. And I'm currently writing one about a type of spacecraft called Waverider, which was invented by an old friend of mine called Terence Non-Wheeler. Was to have been the man-carrying vehicle in the British space program that was cancelled in 1960. And the U.S. Air Force has lately been testing a military version of it, which would have slightly won him because he was a pacifist. But it's time to do a book about it, tell the full story. So that's the one I'm writing right now. But I will do the popular version of Children from the Sky later. But if you want the full story, it's out there right now.
I saw it this morning on Amazon, and I am definitely looking forward to it. I definitely have to get it. Let's take a couple of questions now from our Facebook page. John from Los Angeles asks, the Green Children, were they humanoid? And if not, what does the writing say about their physical appearance?
I'm very glad you asked that question, John. The answer is yes. When they lost the green color, they were described as being indistinguishable from the local people in East Anglia, as if maybe the group they belonged to had been taken from there in the first place. We're talking about abductions with the knowledge, if not the connivance, of some of the terrestrial authorities. It's the X-Files in the 12th century. That's what we've got here. But I have identified the girl to my satisfaction in the historical record. And if she's who I believe her to be, she married Richard Barr, who was one of Henry II's most senior ambassadors, which again tells you that she is somebody very special if she's eligible to do that. And she had children. She had two sons, and I have... One was legitimate and the other was not, and it looks as if there's backstory here that she may not have had her first child willingly. They may have been determined to find out whether or not she was human. But I've traced her from her legitimate son, I've traced her descendants down to the present day. And one of them was deputy leader of the House of Lords under Margaret Thatcher. And he thinks it is an absolute hoot. He was outed by the Glasgow Evening Times in 2007 under the headline, Tory Peer Descended from Green Woman from Outer Space.
Oh my God.
And he said, it sounds bizarre. I knew my ancestors were colourful, but not that colourful.
Well, at least he was jovial about it and didn't get too
absolutely
upset.
I didn't know how he'd take it. I'd never had the nerve to approach him with it. I wrote to him afterwards and said, I'm very glad you've taken it in such good part, but it's quite serious. I can in fact add 200 years to your family tree on that side. And he wrote back saying, never mind about all those boring old people. Tell me about the Green Woman from Outer Space. So he loved it. So, yes, the answer to John's question is definitely human. They'd been, their family group had obviously been taken from Earth, and by a matter transmitter accident, she and her brother had been sent back.
Interesting. Here's a question from Sandy in Arizona. She won't give us what city. She just says Arizona. She says Tesla developed a communication device when he was working with electricity and claimed to have communications from Mars. Are you familiar with his work? And if so, do you think it's legitimate?
Well, I've come across this, yes. I haven't managed to come across any detailed records, so I'm not sure what it was Tesla heard, what significance it would have. But Marconi said this much the same thing. In fact, there was even a suggestion back at the time when I published the Epsilon Botus ideas originally. There was even a suggestion that when Marconi thought that he had first sent signals across the Atlantic, they might have been long-delayed echoes instead. And I'm not sure how valid that idea is, but it's definitely a thought. So yeah, it could be. And the other case for which, again, there is nothing, there's no evidence. But the speculation is quite fascinating, is that John Logie Baird claimed that a lot of his ideas had come to him in his youth when he was experimenting with radio. And suddenly all these ideas supposedly had just come into his head, and he'd gone on to invent television and radar and all the other things, not all of which he's credited with. Yeah, it seems to have been in the air back in the early 20th century, one way and another.
It's interesting that Tesla would report receiving, I've read a little bit about what he says he received, some type of communication that he wasn't able to decipher, but it's funny that all this was happening at the turn of the century, and then now with all of our fancy equipment and long-range radar, we don't have any signals that are discernible. Even Drake's people haven't really qualified any of the signals, and they have expensive equipment. So it's kind of interesting to think about.
Yes, it's almost... It does make you feel uneasy about the whole thing, I mean, I've got to say, but it's almost as if one having attracted our attention, they've turned off, or maybe someone else came along and said, "No, you're not allowed to play with them. They're not going out there."
Leave the Earthlings alone. So let's talk. We'll just take one more question. Our time's quickly coming to a close here. Bob here in San Francisco says, Stonehenge 1 was recently reported by an English scientific group to be a sound device used to modify and change sound. And he wants to know if you read any of these reports and what you thought about the Stonehenge being some kind of a device of that nature.
I know a bit about this. I knew Leslie Banks, who was IBM's head of scientific public relations in the UK back in the 1980s. And he was involved in something called the Dragon Project with Paul Devereux and other people, where they set up radiation detectors and sound detectors at Rollwright and some other stone circles, and found that they were receiving, recording ultrasound and bursts of radiation effects like that that they couldn't explain. Very recently, there have been reports that the blue stones at Stonehenge have similar acoustic properties. I haven't yet seen details on it, but the whole thing about the research that is going on at the moment at Stonehenge and Durrington Walls and the megalithic sites in Scotland, particularly on the Ness of Brongar, the whole picture of Neolithic civilization has changed totally. And what is fascinating about it is that the people like Professor Alexander Tom and Ewan Mackay, to whom my stone circle, the one that I built, is dedicated, they were saying all this 20 or 30 years ago and being denounced as madmen. The famous case where Scientific American published an article saying that these people were no better than Erich von Däniken. And they've now proven to be right, that there really was a Neolithic culture that was capable of doing advanced astronomy. And if they were capable of it, and the sites are still there, I would say it's very hard to argue that they didn't do it. But Alexander Tom and Ewan Mackay and Archie Roy are not getting the credit they deserved. Maybe I have to write another book. But certainly in The Stones and the Stars, I've done my best to put the record straight on this.
Fantastic. Well, Duncan, thank you very much. We've really enjoyed hearing from you and getting the details on Epsilon Buddhis and your research. And where can we look forward to in the next year? Are you going to be in the States at all in the future speaking? Are you in any engagements? What can we look forward to?
I'm available. I have done tours in the past in speaking in the United States, but I haven't been across since 1990. I've been seven times to USA, and I've always thoroughly enjoyed it. I've never left without regret. I've always felt there was more to do before I went up. And,
perhaps somebody can grab you and bring you over here. We'd love to have you over here sometime. Yeah. Well, listen, thank you again, and our time is up, and we appreciate it. And again, the book is Children from the Sky, and I'm sorry, the publisher was who?
Mutus Liber, as in
Mutus
silent
Liber.
Book.
M-U-T-U-S-L-I-B-E-R. And it's available on Amazon, and I saw it today. It's about $22 US, and it looks like a pretty well-researched and good book. So thanks for being with us. I really appreciate it. Now, don't forget, next week we'll have Michael Cremo, Forbidden Archaeology, discussing his latest book and his latest research. So until we hear from you today...